ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors at the ETF store and sponsored by iShares. iShares sponsorship is not an endorsement nor a recommendation for any product or service. iShares is not affiliated with the ETF store, ETF.com, or any of its affiliates. The ETF store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF store product or service. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. All investing involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. The ETF store owns and is responsible for all program content. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate will help you get up to date with what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
Great show this week. As always, I want to thank iShares, the exclusive sponsor of ETF Prime. We are now a mere 14 days away from the election, which this might be the most anticipated election of our lifetimes. There's been so much drama leading up to this that's obviously been magnified by the pandemic and everything else that's gone on in 2020. And my sense is most people are at least a little bit anxious to see how this all plays out. I think no matter where you land politically. Now, from an investment standpoint, obviously you want to remain calm and level-headed. No rash moves in your portfolio. However, there are some potential investment implications here. And in just a moment, I'll be joined by ETF.com Sumeet Roy. This should be interesting. He's going to walk through the various potential election outcomes and handicap how each might impact the markets and ETFs. And of course, nobody knows for sure what will happen, but I do think it can be helpful to think through the different scenarios because at a minimum, that can help prevent you from being surprised. And there could be an opportunity or two to take advantage of. So I'll start there this week. I'll then be joined by Matt Rayner, head of U.S. Strategic Client Group at Principal. He's going to cover a topic I've somehow never covered on the podcast before, preferred securities. Principal offers two actively managed preferred securities ETFs. And the backdrop here is pretty simple, which is that with interest rates so low and bonds not paying much of anything, some investors are looking for alternative sources of income, and preferreds are an option. They offer higher yields. Now, we know in investing, there's no free lunch, right? And so with those higher yields does come higher risk. This should be good. I'm going to have Matt do a quick preferred stocks 101. We'll certainly talk about those ETFs. And then I really want to focus in on the risks and opportunities here, along with where preferreds fit in a portfolio. Also later, I'll be joined by Lisa Chai, senior research analyst at Robo Global. She's going to spotlight the index behind the Robo Global Artificial Intelligence ETF, which basically this seeks to own the top companies involved in developing and leveraging artificial intelligence. That includes some companies we use every day, Spotify, Netflix, Amazon, and also some companies you're likely less familiar with. And I should note, Lisa has a highly impressive background investing in emerging tech companies. So be sure to stick around for that conversation. That should be interesting as well. As always, questions or comments, you can find me on Twitter at Nate Geraci, or you can go to etfprime.com. Let's talk election with ETF.com, Sumeet Roy.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
Just like with the stock, it's a function of the volume of the security. You can often put your limit order in between those two prices. That's if you're still concerned about how do you value cryptocurrencies.
Sumeet, thanks for joining me this week.
Glad to be back on the podcast, Nate. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so just to set the table here, I looked at the latest election data from Predictit, and right now they have Biden as a fairly heavy favorite to win the election. There's also a higher probability the Democrats take both the House and Senate. And then I also saw the betting markets over in the UK. They have Biden with like a 60 to 70% chance to win. Now, of course, we know what happened in 2016, right? All of the polls and predictive markets, they had Hillary Clinton winning. Obviously, that didn't happen. And I still feel like poor Nate Silver, he's still getting beat up over that election. Before we talk markets, do you want to weigh in at all here? I'm not looking for a prediction. I'm just curious, any commentary on the polls or these betting markets?
Yeah, Nate. I mean, if you look at the Real Clear Politics polling average, it's showing Biden up about 9 points nationally. And the polls are also showing, which is just as important, in Congress, the Democrats' 36-seat majority in the House is pretty safe. It's expected to stay the same or increase. But if you look at the Senate, that's where the most uncertainty is. According to the polls, it's a toss-up with the Democrats only slightly favored. Currently, if you look at the makeup of the Senate, the Republicans have a 53-47 majority in that chamber. So if Biden wins the presidency, the Democrats are going to have to flip 3 seats to take the majority since the vice president holds the tie-breaking vote in that case. Otherwise, if Trump wins, they're going to have to win 4 seats to be in the Senate majority. Now, if you look at the prediction markets that you referred to, Nate, the outlook is slightly different than what you see in the polls. Biden is favored over Trump about 60% to 40%, maybe 65% to 35%. So still an advantage, but a much narrower one than the polls are showing with Biden's 9-10% lead in terms of the national polling. And for the House and the Senate, there isn't much difference between what the prediction markets and the polls are saying. So if you aggregate everything, the prediction markets are essentially giving a 50-50 chance of a Democratic sweep. And it's hard to argue with that. They're probably overestimating the chances of a Trump win simply because of what happened in 2016 and that shocking outcome. Now, you know, people are going to speculate about this election all day long, but if you put everything together, what they're essentially saying is a Biden win and a Democratic House are probably the most likely scenarios. Of course, most likely doesn't mean guaranteed. I mean, not even close. You can't count out a repeat of 2016. If you look at the polls for the same date a year ago today, Hillary Clinton was actually up 6 points on Trump right now. And we all know how that ended. But 2016 is 2016. 2020 is a different year, and it's all about probabilities. Just because there were polling errors last time around doesn't mean it's going to happen again. And if you look at the 2018 midterms, the polls are actually very accurate, and the Democrats dominated that election. I'll just end by mentioning that no one knows which party is going to prevail come November 3rd. Even if you concede that Democrats win the presidency and the House, the Senate is way too close to call. And depending which way that goes, that could change everything. So a lot hinges on this election in terms of what type of government we're going to have starting next year.
No, I think all that's well said. And I think that's why everyone's going to be on pins and needles here in a couple of weeks to see, you know, how this all plays out. And I agree. I mean, 2016 is 2016. But I think because of the recency bias, you look back on that and most of the polls and predictive markets, it seemed like a shoo-in that Hillary Clinton was going to win. And I think people feel you know, looking at that example, they just can't shake that with what happened. And so looking at 2020, I think everybody in the back of their minds, they're just discounting the polls and predictive markets at least a little bit.
Definitely.
But look, so as I alluded to at the top, I'm always careful not to put too much stock into elections and how they might impact the markets, just because, number one, you never know, right? We've seen from past elections, again, 2016, the markets don't always react as expected. And then I think number two, at least on a broader level, historical data shows us it doesn't really matter who's in the White House or who controls Congress. Stocks go up over time. There's also going to be some big downturns in between. It's like clockwork. Now, that said, I do think there can be some impact on a more granular level, right? Sectors and subsectors and so forth, or even specific countries, depending upon the policies the U.S. takes. And I do also think it's good for investors to think through potential implications. And the reason for that is just so there aren't any surprises. I think that can help behaviorally with staying on track in your portfolios. So with all of that as a caveat, let's get to the different election scenarios and how they might impact the markets and ETFs. I guess, do you want to comment on any of that before I get to those?
No, I completely agree, Nate. Well said.
Okay, so let's start with maintaining the status quo. Let's say Trump is reelected, the Republicans maintain the Senate, and the Democrats control the House. What do you see happening here?
Yeah, so like you said, this is pretty much what we have today. This is what we've had in terms of government since the 2018 midterms. So what does that mean? It means gridlock. I mean, that's what we've had over the last 2 years. It means any big pieces of legislation probably won't become law. And in particular, it means there probably won't be any significant changes to the tax code, and there won't be any new sweeping healthcare laws or anything like that. In general, gridlock is something the markets like, but the one thing they may be disappointed by in this scenario is the lack of a big COVID relief bill. You're not going to get that $3 trillion stimulus the Democrats want. And assuming the Democrats and Republicans don't come to a deal in the next couple of days, you're more likely to get something like $500 billion that the Republicans have offered, if even that, if a deal has to be made after the elections. So depending how the economy is faring come November and December, and a lot of that hinges on the state of the coronavirus crisis, the market could react very negatively to the prospect of less stimulus or completely shrug it off if we're really close to a vaccine. The other big thing that will probably happen in this scenario is a ratcheting up of tensions with China. They're clearly already very high, but an emboldened President Trump may unleash even harsher measures on China, more tariffs, more blacklists, more sanctions, things like that. And that could weigh on China ETFs like Asher, FXI, and MCHI.
When you mention the gridlock, is that just because it theoretically takes some uncertainty off the table, and that's why markets view that a little bit better, just because you don't have these potential uncertains that can pop up, these unknowns that can pop up?
Absolutely. In general, the less the government does, other than stimulus and tax cuts and things like that, the market usually appreciates that.
Okay, another scenario would be Trump losing the presidency, but there still being a split Congress, right? The Republicans still control the Senate, Democrats still control the House. What do you see in that scenario?
So I think this is one of the two most likely scenarios. This is another split government gridlock scenario. Again, big pieces of legislation probably aren't in the cards if Biden is president and the Republicans hold the Senate. The difference is Biden controls the executive branch in this case, so you may see a more diplomatic, less aggressive posture towards China. It might still be a contentious rivalry. It probably will be, but you're going to fare better in China ETFs than you would under a Trump presidency. Also, you might see a halt to the deregulation agenda that we've seen under the Trump administration. So sectors like energy and financials could get hurt by that. XLE and XLF are actually two of the worst performing sector ETFs this year, so they're likely to continue underperforming in that scenario. On the other hand, clean energy ETFs might benefit, but probably not to the extent that they would under a blue wave.
Okay, well, let's talk about that blue wave, because that would be a third scenario, and this is what the polls and predictive markets are currently expecting, as we mentioned. And, you know, again, take that with a grain of salt. But what happens if we get that so-called blue wave? Biden presidency, Democrats sweeping both the House and the Senate.
Yeah, so the blue wave, along with the scenario we just talked about, I think are two of the most, is one of the two most likely scenarios. And this is essentially when the Democrats unleash the full power of the federal government to support their agenda. The first thing they're going to do if a deal isn't already clinched in the coming days is pass their coronavirus relief bill. Last I checked, that HEROES Act that they want to pass is worth $3 trillion, or 15% of GDP. That's going to be a huge boost for the economy and the financial markets, as you get trillions of dollars working their way through the system. And the implications of that are you're going to see an immediate spike in interest rates, most likely if we get a blue wave. We could easily see the 10-year Treasury go over 1% and the 30-year Treasury yield go over 2%. So ETFs like TLT, IEF, AG, those funds are going to take an initial hit. Now, it wouldn't be all guns blazing for the economy. The stimulus is going to be offset to some extent by the tax hikes that Biden has proposed. He wants to raise the corporate tax rate from 21% to 28%, and he wants to increase the tax rate on long-term capital gains and qualified dividends for incomes over $1 million and a bunch of other tax changes. Those are all net negative for the markets, all else equal, but all else isn't going to be equal. Those tax increases are probably going to be swamped by the massive stimulus and spending bills the Democrats are going to put out. And it's not just the coronavirus relief bill. You're also going to see under a unified Democrat to government tax credits for renewable energy, infrastructure spending. Last I checked, Biden proposed about $2 trillion of spending on green energy and infrastructure. So ETFs like TAN, ICLN, PBW, those are probably going to benefit. Also, Biden, he's proposed to bolster Obamacare and to introduce a public health insurance option for all Americans. So that just means, you know, more Americans are probably going to be insured. And when that happens, healthcare or the demand for healthcare services is naturally going to go up because more people are insured. To some extent, that could be offset by lower drug prices that Biden might negotiate. So something like the healthcare sector, excluding pharma and biotech, might outperform. And if that's the case, you might want to look at areas like med tech and healthcare providers and things like that. IHI and IHF are a couple tickers targeting those areas. But I wouldn't discount the drug companies either. They have historically been extremely resilient, and they have quite a bit of political power as well. So the healthcare sector generally might do well in this scenario. Lastly, like I said earlier, you're going to see more regulation under a Biden administration. So if the Democrats hold the House and Senate also, you could see some pretty stiff antitrust focus on the big tech companies. And that could be a negative for the broad market-weighted tech ETFs that focus on the big mega cap tech companies. But it could also be a boon for the equal-weighted tech funds and those that focus on smaller tech competitors, which could take advantage of their larger rivals' problems. So you can take a look at SMH, which focuses on the semis, CLOU, which focuses on cloud computing stocks, and even ARKW, which is an actively managed technology ETF.
It's so interesting to me as you walk through that particular scenario, because I think in the mainstream media, the narrative is if we get a blue wave, that could be just a negative for the broader market as a whole. But as you mentioned, maybe you have corporate taxes increase, go from 21 to 28%, but then you get an offset from stimulus. It seems like with a lot of what's on the agenda, there are some things that could be a concern for the market, but then there's also things that could be certainly a positive. So there's a lot of offsets there, which I guess creates that uncertainty going back to the current situation with gridlock. When you have gridlock now, you don't have that risk of something really big getting done because everybody can't agree on it. I just think that's interesting exactly. As you walk through that. Okay, and then let's get to this fourth scenario, which would be Republicans sweeping the election, right? So Trump wins, Republicans keep the Senate, and they take back the House. Now, obviously that doesn't look like a realistic option right now, but any quick thoughts on that?
Yeah, so this is one of the least likely scenarios simply because it's going to be extremely difficult for the Republicans to flip almost 20 seats in the House. That said, what would happen under a red wave? Probably more of what we saw in 2016, which is tax cuts of some sort, probably more limited than what we saw back then. We'll also probably see a small COVID relief bill worth probably no more than $500 billion, and of course, more tensions with China. So in that scenario, you're probably going to see more deregulation as well, except when it comes to tech companies. This is something that Republicans agree with Democrats on, though for different reasons. Republicans are especially concerned about bias or perceived bias in social media. So you might see calls to modify or repeal Section 230, which opens up social media and media platforms to lawsuits. And the biggest impact from that will probably be on communication services giants like Facebook and Alphabet. So something like XLC might feel the impact from that.
When you talk about both sides agreeing on tech companies, as I look through the different scenarios here, another area where I feel like both sides generally agree is on infrastructure. And I know you mentioned under the blue wave scenario, the initiatives around clean or renewable energy. I actually talked with Laura Krieger last week about that and you know some of the potential impact. But I think everyone agrees we need to rebuild bridges and roads and airports. I just think with how polarized things have been, neither party wanted to give the other one a win on infrastructure over the past several years, so nothing got done.
But
do you think this could be a potential area that does well regardless of who wins?
I think it could, but I think in general, the Republicans, especially in the Senate, have been more reluctant to spend the trillions that are needed for this. So that's why we probably didn't see it after 2016, even though the Republicans held all branches of the government. So I think both parties want it to some extent, but it's more likely to happen under the blue wave.
Okay, just 2 minutes left. I know this is a bit of a shot in the dark, but I'm curious what you think happens with ETF flows overall the last 2 months of the year, depending upon the election. So if you look right now, ETFs have already had their second best year ever in terms of inflows. So any thoughts on what could happen if Biden wins or Trump wins or we get that so-called blue wave?
Yeah, so as of last week, we're around $353 billion in terms of year-to-date inflows. And November and December are usually good months for flow. So I think we see inflows regardless of the election outcome. I don't think it's really going to make that big of a difference unless the market pulls back big. Barring that setback, though, I think we easily cross $400 billion by the end of the year with an outside shot to surpass the $476 billion record from 2017. We probably won't be able to beat that, but it's close enough where it is in the realm of possibilities.
Well, and of course, the one thing we still have going for us is the Federal Reserve, right? Still,
yeah,
still keeping rates near zero for the foreseeable future and seemingly willing to do whatever it takes. Sumeet, great stuff this week. I really can't wait to see how this election turns out. It's going to be a wild next couple of weeks. We're going to have you back on to discuss the aftermath. But thank you for joining me.
Thanks again for having me, Nate.
That was ETF.com's Sumeet Roy. My next guest is Matt Rayner, head of U.S. Strategic Client Group at Principal, who currently offers 15 ETFs, over $3.5 billion invested, including two preferred securities ETFs, which is what we'll be focusing on this week. Matt is now joining me from Columbus, Ohio. Matt, great having you back on the podcast.
Nate, it's great to be here again. Hopefully you're staying warm in the Midwest.
We are, although I think we do have snow on the way next week, which is a bit disconcerting.
Yeah, which if you get it, we get it, that's for sure.
All right, so look, one of the biggest challenges for investors right now is finding yield, right? Finding income for their portfolios. And I was checking yesterday, the 10-year Treasury, that's currently yielding about 75 basis points. An aggregate bond fund yields around 1.1, 1.2%. There's just not much to squeeze out of traditional bonds. And then even if you look over to stock dividends, those yields are way down. Plus, you get into a situation where you're venturing much further out on the risk spectrum. But before we talk preferred securities and how they might help here, do you want to just offer some additional color on this challenge of finding income and perhaps how it compares historically?
Yeah, I think your observation is spot on. In writing down a few notes this morning, in no particular order, I wrote down election, infection, inflation. Oh my! I think there are a number of unusual global and domestic circumstances that are taking place that even if you look at category flows, has people moving to fixed income as a parking place. But when you marry these challenging capital markets environments, political scenarios, and so forth with a Fed that's basically said low for long, we stand to be in this environment for a long time. And I think one of the even greater challenges is that, you know, historically, when you've been able to look outside the United States for diversification vehicles, things that might offer some attractive yield or risk profiles to further diversify your portfolio, you know, I don't need to tell the audience too much around, not really being able to find it outside the United States as well, where a great deal of foreign fixed income securities are actually in the negative interest rate environment. So, you know, we see this idea of yield, but anytime there's huge yield demand, you know, we get a little bit concerned that people tend to kind of wander aimlessly into places where they perhaps shouldn't be, with exposures they perhaps shouldn't have, or take a overall index-based approach. And one of the things that we're really proud of and seeing good success with right now is our approach to preferred securities as a bit of a ballast for this concern in the marketplace, both currently as well as on a move-forward basis.
Okay, so that's perfect. And I do want to get to the opportunities and risks around preferred securities, but I've got to tell you, my experience is that this isn't necessarily the most well-understood asset class. And so I thought before we get to the ETFs and how to use them in a portfolio, do you mind just offering a quick preferred securities 101, if that's possible? Do you want to explain some basics here?
Yeah, sure. You know, preferred securities is an asset class that's really been around for close to 100 years. I mean, it started back in railroad days where investors were looking for a more superior form of investment opportunity in the railroads from a liquidation standpoint prior to being a common stockholder. So the structure in its most infant form has been around for a long time, but it probably grew in popularity in the 90s during the savings and loans crisis, where preferreds came to the forefront as the raise in preferred securities, the capital raise in preferred securities actually qualified as tier one capital collateral for banks. So it's what we see now is that these are not always, but predominantly offered by financial institutions, not only for the sake of the structure that they provide for investors, but the requirements that they ultimately provide for the banking institution or for financial institutions. There's really three broad categories of preferred securities. $25 par securities you find available on an exchange, callable, you know, have many of the characteristics of fixed income, but really act like an equity as well, so that they're this unique hybrid structure. $1,000 par securities typically find themselves in the institutional community. They're OTC traded, callable as well. And the third and really newest entrant into the preferred securities category are what's known as COCOs or contingent convertibles. These are available in $25 or $1,000 pars, and they're typically issued by European banks. So these three big buckets are kind of the categories of participation in preferred securities predominantly offered by financial institutions. But one of the things I really want to make sure that the listeners are aware of here is, you know, unlike a common stock, where if you can get your arms around what a common stock is, you generally know what common stock is across the board. When you know one preferred security, you really only know one preferred security because the structure of these individual issues can be, you know, as different as your arm is long. Every one of them is a bit unique in structure and offering, in the way the rate is ultimately determined, fixed, floating, and otherwise. So we believe it's really important, and we've capitalized that on the opportunity with Spectrum, our investment manager specializing in preferred securities, to take advantage of this very, very challenging market. To take an active management approach to it, and it's something that we've done well for a long time.
Just boiling all that down, so you often hear that preferred securities, they are hybrid securities, and you alluded to this, they have right. characteristics of both stocks and bonds. And so just as I understand it at a basic level, like stocks, they're typically paid after the company's bondholders in the event of some sort of
right.
liquidation, right? But before stockholders, and thus they're preferred, right?
Yeah, so Nate, let's If you're me, let's go back about 100 years to your Series 7 days and remember this kind of capital structure pyramid. And at the top of that is your kind of senior secured debt holders. And what that simply means is throw capital structure out the window and let's say who gets their money back first in the event of a liquidation. So on the top of that period, the people standing first in line in the event of a liquidation or corporate liquidation are the senior debt holders. Next in line are the junior subordinated, and that's really where preferreds fall, before the common stockholders. So this isn't the top of the pyramid, it's not the bottom pyramid, it's in the middle of the pyramid, and in that middle of the pyramid is where we play, concentrating primarily on investment grade or the highest quality preferred issues that we can find.
Right, and because of where they fall in that pyramid, they can offer higher yields than traditional fixed income securities.
Right, it's not uncommon, for an issue to find 200 to 400 basis points of spread over its senior counterpart in the same capital structure. So there really is an advantage and a premium, but again, you've heard me say it, and I'll reiterate it throughout our conversation this morning, Nate, that because of the structure of these, and they are all so very different, it's really important to understand what you own, because if you find yourself owning a security that ultimately produces negative yield you want to make sure that you have an active management approach or things that will help you navigate this particular part of the market, because it can be difficult.
Yeah, and quickly here, before we get to the ETFs, just high level, what's the purpose of preferred securities? Like, why do companies issue them? You mentioned financial firms, banks. Is it just the flexibility in terms of where they fall in that capital structure? What's the rationale here?
Yeah, really, the rationale these days is, one, to generate investment capital. But like I said earlier, you know, the primaries, particularly now in the regulatory environment that we've seen since 2008 with the introduction of Dodd-Frank and Basel III, regulatory requirements for financial institutions are much, much different than they were in 2008 with much stricter risk requirements in the form of capitalization and so forth. And as preferreds are issued, they are eligible for Tier 1 capital collateral. So it helps the books, it helps them keep their balance sheet clean and meet regulatory requirements, which is why it tends to be such an interesting vehicle for the financial securities industry, banking industry more specifically. But you do see it with utilities, you can see it with REITs, and you can see it with other companies from time to time as well. That's more for investor attraction and raising capital.
Okay, so let's talk about the two principal ETFs in this space. The first one is the Principal Spectrum Preferred Securities Active ETF. The ticker symbol on that is right. PREF. Explain that one for us.
Yeah, if it's okay, Nate, before I get to the product, I think I couldn't describe the product until I talked about the manager, because it's really where we differentiate in our approach. Spectrum, an investment management affiliate of Principal, has been around for 30-plus years. And preferreds isn't something they do. It's really all that they do. This is a preferred securities asset management organization. We run $25.5 billion worth of clients' assets, ranging from large multinational organizations, institutions, to my parents' retirement portfolio. So the application of the security is pretty wide-ranging. We really spend our time, like I said, in the middle of that capital structure, where we feel that there's value to be had. And with the amount of experience, you know, that we've got in the space, you know, Spectrum's been able to be a peer leading provider of options for an ongoing basis. We are a credit shop. Like I said, we kind of go down the cap structure, but maintain a higher quality bias. And Mark Lieb, the CEO and founder of Spectrum Asset Management, on a call in New York with him last week, basically said, look, I've been doing this for four decades, and one, I believe in the asset class, but two, I've never seen long-term reward for dropping down the quality spectrum for the sake of chasing a return. So it's important to know that the products that we've designed and implemented in the marketplace right now are ones that are a higher quality bias, concentrating on active management and seeking the best credits in the space. And with that in mind, again, before I go quickly to the products, they employ a five-part product of their due diligence, and they call it CAMEL, C-A-M-E-L, where they do a risk assessment of capital for the C, asset quality, the management, earnings, and liquidity. And they score each one of those sleeves and ultimately push it through an ESG filter to determine a stack ranking of the credits that they're looking at for sake of allocating to a portfolio. And in doing so, they're really making sure that the best and highest quality offerings in the marketplace are finding representative participation in a portfolio. And what that also does, and this is a really important point relative to the other options that you have in the marketplace right now, this makes us a price maker, not a price taker. So while there are index-based options, there are passive options in the marketplace right now, if you're using a passive option, you kind of have to get what you get. in order to meet your index requirements or your diversification requirements per their mandate. And for that, you might overpay. There's no credit screening in terms of the unique structure characteristics. There is no management around the callability of these securities, generally speaking. So with all this in mind, I guess before I even get to the product is secondary to understanding the due diligence process and care that we take to manage these securities in a bucket. But sorry for the long amble there, but I think it's important
before
we even get to the products. So you mentioned PREF, P-R-E-F. We are particularly excited about this product these days. It fits a very interesting need. So PREF has been around for about 3 years. It's a 4-star rated product, and this product focuses specifically on one of those three buckets that we talked about. These are the $1,000 institutional preferred securities. Goes through the 5-part process that we have, but this concentrates on the institutional market where we typically see less of the whippiness of the retail part of the market in 25s and a little bit different risk characteristic than the COCO on the international offering. So this is the $1,000 only. The distribution yield is 4.6, top decile performer, and really has been a nice addition to portfolios for investors seeking high-quality income, active management. And Nate, when we're offering this thing at 55 basis points for active management and the level of due diligence that we do at the individual credit level, we've been very proud of what this has done for investor portfolios, and it's continuing to gain momentum.
And I know the yields can move around, but can you give listeners an idea as to what this is currently yielding?
Yeah, the distribution yield on this product right now is about 4.6. Clearly, spreads have come in a little bit, but we still feel, you know, relative to investment grade and, unit of income per unit of risk you're taking, this versus a high yield option is particularly attractive. And to that point, you know, this category, preferred securities as a category, let alone the institutional preferred space, has historically, you know, when we think about stepping outside the bounds of the blanket of treasuries and things like that, we begin to think about defaults and the perceived risk in a portfolio. Preferreds historically over the past 10 years have really only averaged about a 0.3, a little more than a 0.3 default rate, 0.3, which makes it feel a heck of a lot more like an investment grade rated portfolio versus about 2.5 on the high yield portfolio. So when you're thinking about portfolio allocations, you got to ask yourself, particularly now that spreads have come in, you know, if I'm only getting 5% in my high yield portfolio or a little better than 5, but 80% of my portfolio is below investment grade to get that unit of risk, I really ought to think about how to diversify that. So that's where we've seen PREF line up with some of the characteristic of fixed income ownership right now.
Okay, and then the other product, which you actually launched earlier this year, back in June, the
right.
Principal Spectrum Tax Advantage Dividend Active ETF, ticker symbol PQDI. What's the difference between that ETF and PREF?
You know, we're really excited about this, and it's a sister product to our PREF offering. We feel like this thing is going to have meaningful legs in the marketplace, and there's going to be great portfolio application. As the symbol would suggest, QDI is qualified income, which allows for the income of this particular portfolio to be almost, if not completely, eligible for lower tax rate. These are dividend distributions, not considered ordinary income. So from an after-tax standpoint, a meaningful, in some cases, 50 to 100 basis points difference in after-tax income. And this portfolio is designed, one, to take advantage of that QDI, the deferred income element of taxation, which, needless to say, regardless of what you think is going to happen in the election, taxes are a meaningful thing in an environment where you're scratching for every basis point that you get in the form of return. This one's going to get some legs. But what I also want to point out is this one has a broader mandate in terms of security participation and the ability to participate in all three of those big buckets I mentioned, the $25 securities, the $1,000 par securities, and the COCOs. So we get a good, broad, wide swath of security participation, still utilizing the stringent credit research of Spectrum, but the design of this is to produce a really interesting tax-efficient income stream that you have to match up these days when we're scrounging for any nickel and dime.
Well, and Matt, on that note, just a couple of minutes left. I want to come back to the risk profile of preferred securities overall. And I mentioned at the top, there's no free lunch in investing, right? And so with higher yields does come higher risk. And I'm just curious, how should investors think about that overall risk profile when looking at preferreds? You mentioned in comparison to high yield bonds earlier, but I'm just trying to get a better feel for that risk return.
Well, you know, I'm really glad you asked that question, because the first people think of when I say, well, these are predominantly issued by financial institutions, and at the heart of even that category are banks. And people are like, oh, banks right now, I'm not really sure. I was around in 2008 and so forth. And what I would say is right now that the environment that we're dealing with, right, is a global concern. It's not a banking concern. And frankly, post the introduction of Basel III and Dodd-Frank, the regulatory elements, you know, banks, if they're not one of the safer, they may actually be the safest sector to participate in from their inability to take risk in the marketplace right now. So one of the things that I would consider in assessing and making an investment allocation is, what is the underlying? What am I really buying? And banking as a sector, based on, you know, really, really stringent regulatory requirements, is one that really is, I hate to use the word safer, but it's a heck of a lot more safe than it's really ever been based on the regulatory requirements. The second is stress testing. You know, for the last 5 years, banks have had to stress test. Now, did they stress test for a pandemic? Of course not, but they have stress tested for conditions and outcomes very similar to this. So, you know, with Spectrum as the asset manager, and again, focusing on the idea that we want to buy the highest quality credits with liquidity and earnings and the like, you know, firms like JP Morgan and others, you know, I would be concerned that the individual issues that I'm owning aren't just the things that got handed to me, that they're the things that somebody who knows what they're doing is ultimately selecting for me. So I'm not in any way suggesting there isn't risk in a category that has spread in it. But what I am suggesting to you, of the options, this is one that can fit nicely in a portfolio, and you can have a managed risk profile as part of your income modeling.
For a traditional 60-40 investor, I've mentioned before when covering high-yield bonds that because of the risk profile of those, perhaps they should come out of the equity sleeve of a portfolio. And when we talk preferred securities, and in particular, investors here preferred stocks, I'm just curious, where should this allocation come from? Does it come out of the equity sleeve of a portfolio or out of the bond sleeve?
Yeah, I mean, the hybrid nature of this, I mean, that's a tough question, only because, you know, we certainly believe in the value of advice and the unique and customized nature that everybody's portfolio is going to look a little bit different. But I do have some biases in here. Right now, I think that you could easily trim, replace, or complement your high yield portfolio. Right now, I think per unit of risk, generally speaking, the type of income that a high yield portfolio is producing may not be worth the credit quality that you're ultimately getting in that right now. So from a fixed income standpoint, where that may be allocated or more recently positioned, either one of the portfolios that we just discussed would be a nice add to or stand next to opportunity, or in many cases a replacement. Also on the fixed income side, you know, investment grade spreads have come way in there. We see pretty meaningful income differences for the very similar characteristics of risk. I think you could step out there. But the other point I'd make here is when you're, if I was looking at my book right now, my client portfolios, and I said, geez, you know, I'm thinking about where I've indexed or been using passive options, and maybe I haven't looked under the hood as closely as I could, because there are a lot of mousetraps out there right now. And just because something says it's going to distribute something doesn't mean that it's going to see it through to the end, particularly for newer participants in the market. So what I would say is, you know, as opposed to saying stocks or bonds, you might say consider the structure that you've used to participate, particularly as we approach tax season here. If you could avoid a capital gain, swap to a higher quality portfolio, maintain most of the income characteristics, and in many cases reduce the price to do it, I think we have a couple of really nice options.
Well, Matt, really interesting space. Again, this just doesn't get as much attention. It's a bit under the radar, but I thought you did a great job of explaining it this week. So thank you for joining me.
My pleasure. Great to be here as always.
That was Matt Rayner, head of U.S. Strategic Client Group at Principal. I'm now joined by Lisa Chai, Senior Research Analyst at Robo Global, who currently offers three ETFs, nearly $1.5 billion invested, including the Robo Global Artificial Intelligence ETF, ticker symbol THNQ. That's what we'll be spotlighting this week. Lisa is on the line with me from New York. Lisa, it's a pleasure. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so before we get to the ETF and the index, I have to ask you about your background, because I was looking at your bio. You have an impressive track record of working with emerging tech companies. I also saw you're currently a member of the Empire Angels, which invests in early stage tech ventures. You're a strategic advisor to a blockchain growth lab. Tell us a little bit more about your background.
Sure. I have over 15 years of experience working in asset management, primarily in equity markets, focusing on technology and the consumer sectors. I have always been very passionate about learning and investing in the disruptive technology arena, and have been an advisor to various startups in emerging growth industries, especially in the field of artificial intelligence, healthcare, and blockchain. So most recently, I worked as a strategic advisor for a blockchain growth lab funded by several large technology companies with a big focus on enterprise use cases. And I'm also one of the members, as you stated, of the Empire Angels. We are the youngest professional angel group out of New York and London. And I see a lot of dynamic trends and companies in early stage ventures. We look at these investments with a unique perspective, which is to look at companies that are well positioned, but for the millennial generation.
And just so, go ahead.
Yeah, so through this sort of startup network community, I connected with the partners at Robo Global about joining the team in about 2018 to bring sort of broad insights into industry trends, help the research team identify companies, and help structure additional index strategies that we think are compelling and truly unique in how we can capture the disruptive innovation theme to our investors.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I was going to ask you, is how you ended up at Robo Global. And so right now, you're currently effectively the portfolio manager for the Robo Global Artificial Intelligence ETF. Again, ticker symbol THNQ. Let's go through the index behind this ETF, and then I want to come back and talk investment case. Break down this index for us.
Sure. It was just launched in May of this year, so we're very excited about it. As you know, Nate, we have been following the areas of automation AI for over 7 years now, since the company was founded in 2013. We are the creator of the first robotics automation and AI index strategy in the marketplace. A few years ago, we started to see some secular and structural shifts happening around companies building AI capabilities, and we decided to dig a little deeper. And what we found was pretty interesting. It has become increasingly clear to us that AI has hit an inflection point and is in the early stages of adoption. So machine intelligence powered by AI is playing a very important role in every vertical we follow. And that's why we created the Think Index, which is a pure play strategy focused on companies involved in developing AI infrastructure and those companies that are leveraging AI to go after massive revenue opportunities. We think that building AI capabilities and expertise is not something that anyone can do overnight. It will take many years for most of the companies to build AI technologies. And the good news is that we're still in the early innings of capturing this innovational impact that AI is providing to the world. And so we took a research-driven approach for company selection based on long-term value drivers. We look for companies with high revenue purity around AI and companies that invested in AI capabilities. We think investment is an important metric and a very strong indicator of future revenue growth. So we look for market leaders as well as technology leaders that are well-run and are in good financial health. In fact, about 67% of companies in the Think Index have net cash positions on their balance sheet. And that is very important to us. So we score these metrics using our Think AI score. We meet with management teams on a regular basis. We attend industry conferences, develop relationships with industry experts. And we have an internal database system to constantly score these companies on various metrics I just described. And every quarter, we reconstitute and we rebalance the index, which means we sell our winners and buy our losers, which is a way of to sort of ensure that the fund buys low and sells high as much as possible. So though currently, the Think portfolio consists of about 70 index members that are very diversified in terms of market cap, in terms of in markets that they play in, and also in terms of their business model. We think it truly captures the broader AI ecosystem around the world, with almost 30% of the members being outside the U.S. The strategy also has a pretty low overlap with traditional technology equity funds. And this approach has worked extremely well with the Think Fund, with very strong returns so far. As of September 30th, Think has delivered total returns of over 35% for the year, outperforming all of the global market indices. And when we look at a back test of the past 3 to 5 years, the return continues to outperform above 30 to 35% per year on an annualized basis.
Lisa, as I look through the constituents in this index, I found this to be a really interesting mix. So I think definitely some names people would recognize. I saw Amazon, Microsoft, Spotify, Netflix, Alphabet. But then there are some names perhaps not quite as familiar. Veeva Systems, iRobot, Verisight. Can you talk about this mix and maybe highlight a couple of the lesser known names?
Sure. We divided up the kind of the index into infrastructure and applications. So on the infrastructure side, you're going to find the cloud providers. You're going to find leaders in semiconductors enabling AI in the data center environment. And then in the application side, these are the companies that are leveraging AI to go after that massive revenue opportunities. These companies are in the business process and digital transformation. So, for example, in the e-commerce subsector, under applications, you're going to find companies like Shopify and Wix that are empowering small businesses looking to build their online presence. In also companies that are like Netflix and Spotify. I think many companies many people don't understand that Netflix is, they are an AI company. People think they're a media company, but the company is a really good example of how AI can make a big impact to a business model that will not only sustain the revenue growth, but also take a dominant role in the market that they play in. Netflix uses AI algorithms extensively throughout their business. AI analyzes and predicts your movie preference by looking at watching history of other users with similar tastes to give you personalized user interface and recommend what you may be most interested in watching next. It goes through thousands of video frames of a movie or show to provide a particular image for you to have that highest likelihood of resulting in your click. Spotify does the same. Without these streaming content providers using AI, they will probably cease to exist. But these companies embrace AI and providing us with good user experience. And both of these companies had a phenomenal run this year, and we think this is sustainable. To the extent that we as consumers will continue to subscribe to these services with these unmatched technology that keeps us engaged, we think companies like Netflix and Spotify has a strong runway. And Veeva, you mentioned, very interesting story. It's a CRM software provider for the life sciences industry. Companies, like you said, relatively unknown, underfollowed. Its software is used by 19 of the top 20 pharma companies today for drug discovery and running clinical trials. It has a strong AI power engine that helps with data management and analysis during the entire life cycle of drug development, from initial clinical trials to marketing and sales. The company has basically demonstrated leadership with strong revenue growth north of 25%, and shares are up over 100% year to date. And then iRobot is obviously the world's leading consumer robot company with their line of Roomba robotic vacuum. iRobot has been one of our top performing stock in the artificial intelligence index this year, up more than 80% year to date. They are at the crossroads of some of the most powerful trends in robotics and AI as we begin adopting more smart devices into our lives. This device has sophisticated mapping technology with imaging recognition capabilities that remembers the layout of your home and knows exactly where to go for that additional round of vacuuming, which is pretty cool. The Roomba vacuum cleaners have been used in more than 20 million homes worldwide. But yet, Nate, global household penetration remains in the single digits. So we think iRobot is a unique growth story and a good example of an index member where it scored very high on AI revenue purity.
Lisa, just a couple of minutes left. You mentioned earlier the Robo Global Robotics and Automation Index. The ETF behind that, or the ETF on that, is Robo, R-O-B-O. And I think a lot of our listeners are familiar with that ETF. I'm just curious, what are the differences between that index and the index behind TH and Q?
Mm-hmm. There are some similarities that both strategies are very diversified, but also very big differences between the two, where Robo Index captures the entire value chain of robotics, automation, and AI companies. Think Index is a pure play strategy focused just on artificial intelligence. And much like Robo, Think Index strategy was built around the technology and infrastructure providers and service and application providers. But the overlap between the two strategies are less than 15%. So that tells you that we have a lot of different companies in the Think Index. Think Index, you will see that it has a larger market cap tilt than the Robo Index. Think Index also, because it captures the entire ecosystem of AI, it has a bigger tilt to the technology companies that have the resources to develop and build AI capabilities. So you need quite a bit of resources to build that AI team.
And by the way, did I see there was an ESG screen on THNQ as well? What's the purpose of that?
I think ESG is just an increasingly important part of our process. It's embedded in all of our index strategies and portfolio construction methodologies. We exclude companies that fail our policy. And I think it's also important to kind of highlight that our themes tend to naturally lean towards positive ESG, because automation and AI is largely about increasing efficiency. And many have also lower environmental impact and freeing up time for humans to focus on kind of higher value activities. We work with a leading ESG research company that was recently acquired by Morningstar to kind of support our efforts.
Well, Lisa, we'll have to leave it there. Really nice spotlight this week. Certainly a unique space, and I wish you the best of luck with the ETF. Thank you for joining me.
Great. Thank you so much.
That was Lisa Chai, Senior Research Analyst at Robo Global. That'll do it for this week's ETF Prime. I want to thank our exclusive sponsor, iShares. You can visit iShares.com to learn more about their investment strategies. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Nate Geraci, or you can send comments through ETFPrime.com. Next week, I'll be joined by CFRA's Todd Rosenbluth. He's going to cover a number of different ETF topics. And then GlobalX's Jay Jacobs will talk thematic ETFs. Until then, have a great week, everyone.